And good afternoon. You're listening to Unusual Sources on 93.3 CFMU FM. We have a special guest all the way from England today. I'm very pleased to have with us today on the program, Philip Hammond. Now, he is reader in media and communications at London South Bank University, and he's the author of Framing Post-Cold War Conflicts, published by Manchester University Press, which you can catch on Amazon. And of course, he's a columnist for Spiked magazine in the UK, which has been giving us some great coverage on Sudan. Philip has been writing a lot about intervention, whether it be in Kosovo or Darfur. So, Philip, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on our program today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm very excited to talk about this. Your article has raised some very interesting details about the way that celebrities are handling what are being called humanitarian crises abroad. We've been hearing a lot from George Clooney, for example, on the issue of Sudan, and Mia Farrow recently as well. There's some facts that our listeners might not know about Mia Farrow and the way she's been asking for intervention in Darfur. Could you just tell our listeners what Mia Farrow has been advocating in relation to the Darfur conflict?
Well, I think you're alluding to the fact that this summer, in August, she reportedly held a meeting with the private security firm Blackwater, who the U.S. government has subcontracted to in Iraq, famously, and to try and explore the possibility. Mia Farrow thought that it would be a good idea to get this private security firm to send forces to beef up the African Union peacekeeping force and make it a kind of tougher intervention. She said, when questioned about it, that Blackwater has a much better idea of what an effective peacekeeping mission would look like than Western governments do, which is a kind of strange claim because, you know, Blackwater had a kind of controversial record in Iraq, accused of murdering civilians and so on. It's a slightly kind of bizarre plan that she came up with there, but it sort of expresses the kind of wider determination of other celebrities and also of the kind of Save Darfur campaigners to see a very tough Western intervention there. Around the same time that Mia Farrow was talking to Blackwater, Save Darfur were parking a helicopter outside the UN building in New York with a banner on it saying, "Send me to Darfur." You know, again, with the idea that tough military action is what's needed there.
This is very saddening. I remember interviewing an American guest, a professor, Gary Loop, in the United States, and he had seen some of these Save Darfur rallies, and as an anti-war activist, he was horrified because he said, what we're witnessing is a pro-war rally. When so many people are trying to get the United States and Great Britain out of Iraq, here you have people saying, let's send helicopters, let's send Blackwater into Sudan. There's also the case of George Clooney, of course. He was recently all over the news for calling the Chinese Olympics the Genocide Olympics. And Clooney said that Darfur is a very simple conflict. It's not a political issue. There's only right and wrong. Now, you wrote about this attitude in your article. Are you saying that Save Darfur activists and interventionists are basically trying to promote a very black and white view of the conflict?
I think definitely they have, and in part sort of deliberately so. You know, I've read accounts by people who've been involved in sort of campaigning around the issue, and they say, look, well, we know we are simplifying a little bit, but it's worth doing that because that will present a kind of stark message and that will stir people to feel that intervention is necessary. It's a strange thing, but it's not so much a kind of an understanding of the conflict that then leads to a conviction that there must be intervention. It's more the other way around, that the idea that there must be some kind of moral intervention motivates, in some cases, activists to declare, well, never mind the complexity, it's all very simple, even though, at least in some cases, I think they know that that's a bit of a distortion. It is a strange phenomenon that you can have, you know, people like George Clooney, who can be, you know, simultaneously present themselves as anti-war, in the case of Iraq, and be pro-Western military intervention in the case of Darfur, with no sense of contradiction. I think what it comes down to is a kind of a desire to see a moral role being played in international affairs by the United States and other Western powers.
We should get back to this moral role. I wanted to go back to the issue of Sudan itself. Now, the most strident activists calling for intervention are suggesting that it's a genocide. But you've suggested that there's problems with characterizing the conflict as a genocide. Why would you say that?
Well, I mean, it's not just me. I think most informed commentators about it recognize that it's that's a kind of drastic, not just an oversimplification, but a kind of misrepresentation, really, of what the conflict was like. I mean, I've got no doubt that the Sudanese government, the military, their local militia allies have done terrible things to the rebels, but let's bear in mind that the government was responding to an armed rebel movement. It wasn't as if they sat down and said, right, let's wipe out a certain section of the Sudanese population living in Darfur. That's just not what happened. I think that the determination to characterize it as genocide has very little to do with the facts on the ground. Even if you wanted to characterize the violence in that way, which I think it doesn't really make sense to characterize it in that way, but even if you did, you'd have to see that the worst of the violence is long over, and yet it doesn't seem to have any impact on the campaigners who say, well, it's still going on, we must intervene. As I say, I think there's a sense in which the campaigning and the rhetoric and the celebrity activism is at one remove from what's actually going on the ground in Darfur. Alex de Waal, who's a pretty well-recognized expert on Sudan, makes the point that when George Clooney was addressing the UN Security Council a couple of years ago and saying, unless the West acts now, millions will die, in fact what was happening was completely different. In fact what was happening was that the government forces were getting hammered by the rebels. In Darfur, there's, as I say, a total disconnection between events on the ground and the kind of high-flown, moralized rhetoric that we get in the kind of Western media discussion.
Certainly, your research and the research that's been done by other people suggest that this is an armed conflict between two or more sides, in part instigated by rebels. You also mentioned that 2 million Darfuris have sought refuge near Sudanese government garrisons. That suggests that the government itself does not have genocidal intent.
No, indeed. And that was Lonnie Brauman, who's the former president of Maison Sans Frontières, pointed that out. And he was objecting to the same thing, which is this kind of ridiculous oversimplification, which makes it out as if, and I think this is a fairly widespread perception of not just Sudan, but conflicts in kind of weaker countries around the world quite often nowadays, which is they're not about politics and interests and conflict over resources or sort of strategic differences and so on. These things are seen in very, very black and white terms. There's a kind of instinct to try and find some good guys and some bad guys. It totally doesn't make sense, that I don't think, in relation to Darfur. The rebel movement, as you say, it started off with two main groups, the Sudan Liberation Army and the Justice and Equality Movement. That's now, splintered into, each of those groups is splintered into several factions. When one of the rebel factions signed an agreement with, a peace agreement with the government in 2006, they actually joined forces with the government side and started attacking other rebel groups. So the idea that you can draw a neat dividing line and say, here's good, here's evil, we must intervene on the side of good and defeat the evil, is it's completely unhelpful as any kind of approach to the conflict. It's more about, I think, making Westerners trying to make themselves feel good about having this kind of morally superior attitude to it.
We see.
I might also add that I think that actually not only is it not helpful, it actually, I think, makes things worse. That, you know, the kind of the sense that there are powerful, influential, sometimes quite kind of glamorous, high-profile voices in the West who back one side in the Civil War, you know, it's a powerful incentive not to compromise and not to come to any agreement and not to seek peace, but to hold out.
Indeed.
In the hope that a Western savior will step in.
I believe the editor of Spike, I think Brendan O'Neill, had suggested that in the case of Sudan, the fact that they're receiving so much external pressure and so much external activism on the Sudan issue has led the rebel movements not to sue for peace like they ordinarily would have. They feel emboldened, and this is in fact prolonging the conflict in Sudan and in Darfur.
Well, I think that's correct, and it's not the first time that that's happened. You know, we saw that, for example, in the 90s with Bosnia, where especially the US and other Western governments essentially persuaded the Bosnian Muslims that they should hold out for a better deal. And the deal they ended up getting was no better than a deal they could have had much earlier, with far fewer lives being lost. But the, you know, when powerful outside actors wade in, it kind of distorts the dynamics of these local conflicts. It makes compromise and some kind of peace agreement actually less likely sometimes than being helpful in any way.
We keep seeing parallels to Kosovo. For example, the case of rebels instigating a conflict and then a government crackdown. And I think the way that our media in the West has handled it is very comparable. There's a definite case of worthy, unworthy victims and good guys, bad guys. Do you think we're getting a case of he's the next Hitlerism when it comes to Sudan? During the intervention in Yugoslavia in 99, we were told that Milosevic was the next Hitler and there was a genocide, so we had to send in military forces. And then the war with Saddam in 2003, Saddam was the next Hitler and they invoked a number of atrocities. So is this a trend that we just keep bringing up?
Yeah, well, I think that you know, you could certainly see a parallel, for example, in terms of the role played by the you know, international war crimes tribunals. That during the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, the supposedly impartial criminal tribunal at The Hague effectively endorsed NATO action by declaring that Slobodan Milosevic was under charge of war crimes. And you know, this kind of judicial body effectively lent their kind of legal approval to the NATO campaign. Well, now there's an attempt to do something very similar in the case of Sudan. There's an indictment being considered right now for President Bashir of Sudan, again, this time by the International Criminal Court. So the way I would understand it is, I mean, probably lots of different motivations involved by different individuals, but I think that, broadly speaking, what you see is an attempt, as I say, to kind of establish a kind of moral superiority, which of course has been battered in recent years by the whole experience, especially of Iraq and more broadly the war on terror. And more kind of liberal folks, people like Clooney or Mia Farrow and so on, they've appeared to be kind of anti-war in relation to Iraq, but actually it's more about opposing an intervention that has undermined Western moral authority and re-establishing that moral authority through mechanisms such as the International Criminal Court, I think is the kind of, you know, what kind of motivates them.
So it's about creating a liberal justification for intervention as opposed to just a standard George Bush type.
Yeah, kind of resurrecting the idea of liberal interventionism that was you know, more popular in the 1990s. Whether that can be done or not, I don't know. You know, if Barack Obama was to get elected in a few days' time, I think a lot of people would start to get excited and think that maybe that was on the cards. I know that in Britain, I've heard lots of people discussing exactly that idea, that perhaps there could be some rejuvenated form of humanitarian interventionism. How realistic that is, I'm not sure. Because the other kind of strange feature of these conflicts is that Western intervention, damaging though it is, is also at the same time, in part of, in a way, what makes it so damaging is that it's kind of hesitant and ad hoc, and you know, it's not about kind of seizing control of territory in the kind of old-fashioned imperialism. So, I mean, again, if you think back to the 1990s, a lot of kind of liberal interventionists complained for years, indeed, that the West was not doing enough in Bosnia, even as Western policies were in many ways making the war worse and prolonging the conflict. So there's a kind of, you know, it's a kind of a sort of damaging but at the same time reticent Western interventionism that we've seen before, and we may well see more of it again.
Well, you have to build a case beforehand, I think. We spoke with Edward S. Herman about Yugoslavia on our program,
yeah.
And he said that the academics and activists that wanted intervention had to work very hard in the media to get their points put around the media so that they could build a case for intervention. And it took some time to sway the media over to a very one-sided perspective. In the case of Sudan, you mentioned that the Save Darfur movement and activists were very excited once they were able to get the United States to call Sudan and Darfur a genocide. It was an unimaginable coup. So these activists seem more concerned over public relations fanfare than getting serious and credible information across.
Oh, I think that's definitely the case, yes. And that phrase, an unimaginable coup, you know, that's former activists themselves saying that in full knowledge that, you know, in doing so, they've been obliged to simplify and distort the kind of presentation of events in Sudan. So I think that, you know, that, yes, indeed, there has to be a kind of, if you like, a kind of propaganda campaign on the part of activists and allies in the media to kind of prepare the ground, I guess, for the kind of intervention they'd like to see. Although, I guess what I'm trying to say is it doesn't always issue in that kind of tough, direct military engagement. Equally damaging can be the kind of more hesitant, ad hoc, buck-passing style of intervention, where, I mean, for example, a good example in the case of Darfur, I think, is the international mediation that produced the Darfur peace agreement a couple of years ago, where the effort was put in, and, you know, people who were involved in the mediation have said this, that the effort seemed to be all about getting this piece of paper. It wasn't really about resolving a conflict. It was about being able to turn around and say, look, we've done it. We've got something on paper, and we've imposed the will of the international community and made everyone fall into line. Well, you know, that's a kind of half-hearted intervention in one sense, but it's also an extremely damaging one, and it splintered the rebel movement. It made compromise less likely. You know, it didn't leave Sudan in a better state. In fact, it left it in a worse state. So it's a strange kind of combination of a face of ad hoc and yet severely sort of damaging outside interference.
But before we go, I'd just like to chat a little more on the concept of genocide itself, the way it's used as a term, because it seems to me there's a lot of sensationalism. Every time there's a conflict in Africa, it's called a genocide. Remember that election in Kenya? There were warnings that could turn into a genocide. I mean, why is this done? Is this just pure hyperbole?
Well, I think that it's, the way I would understand it, it's a kind of search for, as I say, for sort of moral clarity, that it's the most powerful, resonant way in which you can say to people, look, here's evil and we must defeat evil, if you can brand something as genocide. In the case of African conflict specifically, I think that the experience of Rwanda also exercises a kind of powerful influence over the imagination. And those Darfur activists, one of the reasons that they were so keen to get the U.S. government and others to use the term genocide is because they thought that back in 1994, it was the reluctance to say that Rwanda was genocide, which then meant that the U.S. wasn't obliged to intervene. If only they said it was genocide, then they would have sent in the troops. Well, this time, the U.S. said, yes, it's genocide, but we're not you know, so what? That doesn't mean we're going to, you know, send a military force or something. I think there's a, you know, there's a kind of fundamental misunderstanding there about the history of Rwanda, when in fact the US did intervene. It just, it didn't intervene in the way that people wanted it to. The way that it did intervene was essentially by backing one side. It essentially supported the RPF in 1994. So there's this kind of misconception that if only we could get this moral clarity, then everything would be put right. And it's a kind of story that you know, liberal interventionists tell, often with a sense of frustration that they can't persuade Western governments and international agencies to take this tough line. But at the same time, you know, in a way, they're doing the people that they're trying to put the pressure on, they're doing them a favor. They're doing Western governments a favor because inevitably they're the ones who are kind of cast in the role of potential savior. They're saying, you can, if only you would send in your forces, you would be saving the world. And every now and then, Western governments say, oh, all right, then we will. And in they go, as for example happened in Kosovo in 1999.
And that, of course, has led to the secession of Kosovo from Yugoslavia. There's fears of South Sudan seceding from Sudan and oil regions. It's all very complicated politics that's not addressed. But you've, of course, mentioned that the Save Darfur activists like to compare the conflict in Sudan to the perception of Rwanda instead of comparing the Darfur conflict to other conflicts in Sudan. The way this is studied is very dubious. There's entire academic departments at universities where scholars make a career out of studying genocides. You talked about Totin and Marcuse in your article. Do you think it's possible to go about studying genocide in the way that it's done in the universities?
Well, yes, they sort of characterize themselves as genocide scholars. I think it doesn't really... I mean, one of the things that people often say about genocide is that it's a kind of separate category, that you have to abstract it from its context, because if you put it in the context of war, then that somehow minimizes it and doesn't kind of make it morally clear enough how evil it is. But I think that's a highly mistaken line to take. I don't think you can get some kind of spurious moral clarity, I suppose, but you do so at the expense of really understanding the dynamics of whatever conflict it is that you're discussing. Inevitably, you know, if there is conflict and it leads to, in some cases, it actually does lead to genocide, well, you need to understand that in the context of the conflict that's going on, not abstract it out. Now, nowadays, there is this tendency to see genocide almost everywhere. You know, as you say, with Kenya, you know, even quite a minor flare-up of violence leads the word genocide to be on people's lips, almost sort of without thinking. I think part of that is a kind of inability to find a way to explain contemporary conflicts. They seem somehow incomprehensible, and part of the reason that they seem like that is because they're viewed through this strange prism of trying to figure out what is the West's role in the world in this kind of post-Cold War landscape. And there's this constant temptation to try and divide the world into these kind of good guys and bad guys. Ooh, genocide, evil's happening here. That must mean that we're the forces of light and goodness and can step in to do something about it. So, you know, I think it's, my own feeling is it's very unhelpful to abstract out violence from its social and political context and say, oh, look, it's all just instances of genocide. All you end up doing is kind of distorting any kind of understanding of what the real dynamics of violence are. You make it into some sort of metaphysical question of good versus evil.
I'm going to wrap up the discussion there. I kept giving more questions, but you've given us such insight that my curiosity continues. If you want, just for fun, I mean, I'd like to ask about celebrity attitudes briefly, because we know we have to watch out for George Clooney and we have to watch out for Mia Farrow, and it was Vanessa Redgrave who told us to bomb Yugoslavia in 99. So, does this have anything to do with the way all the celebrities are adopting African babies? And, you know, what about Bono? Where does he fit into this?
Yeah, it's a strange kind of thing, the elevation of the celebrity activist. You know, there is this sense in which, and I think celebrities such as Bono know very well that this is the position they're in, and they feel a bit uncomfortable about it. They're kind of self-appointed spokesmen for people who they don't really represent. They, you know, in their own minds, they represent millions of people in Africa or Asia or wherever they'd like to think that they represent people. And oddly enough, they kind of get away with it, and they're kind of taken seriously. And invited into international forums, invited to address the UN Security Council, and so on. And the other odd aspect, as you say, with kind of, you know, adopting babies, you know, figures like Angelina Jolie and Madonna, you know, they feel that they can go into African countries, ignore the local laws, adopt a baby if they feel like it. If they're, in Angelina Jolie's case, then it involves kind of telling the government of Namibia, you know, this is how you will run your country while I'm here having a baby, and kind of dictating to these states and kind of swanning around as if they're, you know, from some superior race of beings. It's a very peculiar thing, but I think what it does is it kind of, in a sort of comic book form almost, it dramatizes the relationship, the post-Cold War relationship between the West and the Third World, where the sovereignty of weaker states is no longer seen to count for very much. You know, there used to be, under the old UN system, there used to be this principle of non-interference in a state's internal affairs, a principle of sovereign equality, that all states were treated equally. After the end of the Cold War, those rules have really no longer applied. They've been violated time and again. And the kind of the celebrity walks around kind of embodying that attitude, I think, towards you know, towards weaker states in the Third World, or even indeed in Eastern Europe.
Indeed, these celebrities have a very large burden on their shoulders.
They do, don't they? Yeah.
Well, Phil, you've given us, as I said, a great deal of insight into this subject. So I thank you very much for taking the time and for calling all the way across the Atlantic to come on our program today.
It's been a pleasure.